You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome back, cinephiles, to another thrilling episode of the Silver Screen Cinema Classics podcast. As always, I am your host, Captain Mike, on this mission joined by the ever-knowledgeable Warrant Officer DK.
Hello.
It's cool to have you here again to discuss all things Alien. And today we have a real treat for you. As I've said, we're delving into the dark, claustrophobic corridors of the USCSS Nostromo. Yes, you guessed it, to commemorate the release of another new sequel in cinemas, as well as the 45th anniversary of this original classic, we're going right to the edge of our permitted classic years and talking about the 1979 sci-fi horror masterpiece, Alien. And as if that wasn't exciting enough, we're once again joined by a returning guest. She's got a flamethrower at the ready and her cat carrier just in case things get out of hand. It's Sandy Evanson. Welcome back, Sandy.
Right.
You know, you're like a parrot, all you say is right.
Right.
Good. And as I said off air, this is the same team that reviewed Prometheus, so the only way is up for this franchise. But just a quick plug for that one if you haven't had a chance to listen to it. I promise our review is more entertaining than the movie. So, over to you, TK.
Yep. We're keeping our eyes peeled because you never know when a facehugger might show up. I've been at that nightclub. But seriously, folks, Alien is one of those films that redefined a genre. It's a movie that made us all a little bit afraid of the dark, and even more afraid of what might be lurking in our air ducts. Ridley Scott's direction, H.R. Giger's iconic alien design, and of course Sigourney Weaver's legendary performance as Ellen Ripley. There's just so much to unpack in this. And let's not forget about Jonesy, the bravest cat in space.
Ah, Jonesy, the real hero of the story. I think we can all agree that cat deserves its own spin-off. But seriously, though, Alien is more than just a scare fest. It's a brilliant exploration of corporate greed, the expendability of the working class, and, of course, the ultimate survival story. Plus, who doesn't love a good chestburster scene over breakfast?
Yeah, that scene alone is probably really more appetizing than any other in cinema history. And it gave us all a valuable lesson. Never, ever trust a free meal from your spaceship's android. Speaking of which, we'll dive into the enigmatic and unsettling Ash, played by the always brilliant Ian Holm. And how about those special effects, folks? Practical effects that still hold up today. And the sheer suspense that Scott managed to create with what was, at the time, a relatively modest budget. It's really no wonder this film spawned an entire franchise.
Plus, of course, it taught us the most important survival tip of all. In space, no one can hear you scream. What a tagline. But your podcast audience certainly can, so grab your motion trackers and your pulse rifles, folks. We're about to explore every dark and sinister corner of Alien. We promise to keep the chest bursting to a minimum, though we can't guarantee there won't be some spine-tingling moments. So strap in, keep an eye out for any unusual eggs, and let's get this deep space discussion underway. So we don't really need to ask everybody's favourite cinema classic because we've been over that numerous times now. So instead, we'll kick off this Nostromo nostalgia trip, as we usually do, by each of us being asked what our first experiences are with this film. And since you're the guest, Sandra, and you've been very quiet up to now, I'm going to come to you first. Can you remember the first time you ever saw Alien and what impact and effect it had on you?
I don't think I can remember my first time. watching the movie. I know it must have been with my aunt because she was the only one that ever watched scary things, and they had cable. But it's just something, a movie that's pretty much always been present. My family did like sci-fi, and I just have always, I've always watched it. But what's funny is I kind of kept my child's view of the movie this whole time. Oh. And it wasn't until actually reading some stuff about the movie in preparation for this podcast that I found out that the alien on the ship was the chest burster had just grown that fast. This whole time I thought the big alien had just snuck onto the ship unbeknownst to them.
It shows you Brett literally picking up its molted skin. Did you not put two and two together from that bit?
No, I thought it was growing, but I didn't think... I mean, where was the in-between molts? I mean...
off screen.
But yeah, just this past couple of days put that together.
So yeah, what about you, DK, then? What was your first experience with Alien? And can you remember even?
How old do you think I am, dude? It's... Yeah, all right, it's hazy. You know how we were talking last episode with regards to getting Rocky 1 and 2, some scenes mixed up?
Mm-hmm.
I've got a similar thing with Alien. I saw this when I was very, very young. And I also saw Invasion of the Body Snatchers when I was very, very... The remake, by the way. And
the 70s reason, one, yeah.
Yeah, I, for some reason, I do get occasionally these kind of mixed up in my head as well, which is a big mindfuck when you think about it.
You're looking for Jeff Goldblum the entire time? Like,
well, who wouldn't?
Somehow he was on the ship somewhere.
Yeah. I remember seeing both of these when I was very, very young. And then I kind of, for some reason, I completely blanked this one. I don't think it's through trauma because I freaking love it. And then... My mother loves this film, and she would talk about it constantly. And then we went into a video... Yeah, all right, I am old. We went into a video store, and...
don't worry.
Yeah, they had an ex-rental copy. I didn't know... I couldn't remember a damn thing about it. So I bought it, took it home, and... Yeah, life was never the same, really.
Fair enough. Cool. The reason that I said, you know, can you even remember? I genuinely can't remember the first time that I saw this film. It wouldn't have been when I was super young, although it might have been, because I wasn't really into horror films. But I remember this being one of the few horror films that I was able to watch, and I've never really found it all that scary for some reason. I don't know why. It seems like it should have that effect, but yeah. So I can't remember the first time I saw it, but I know that I've seen it many a time. I'm sure I'll get into it in the, you know, the podcast and in the conclusion, but I still way much prefer the sequel, which I've seen, you know, probably 4 or 5 times more often than I've seen this original one. But yeah, my kind of introduction to it properly, the thing that I remember most vividly was getting and being obsessed with, and I'm still obsessed with it, the box set that they brought out, first on DVD and now it's on Blu-ray, of the 4 Alien movies, the first 4.
Oh, no,
with, like, new director's cuts.
Yeah, that, it was a trilogy. It was a trilogy when I got my box set, and it should have remained a freaking trilogy.
Well, no, the thing is, they kind of, the box set that they brought out for the quadrilogy, as it were, it had so much extra stuff because there's, like I said, they included the extended version of Aliens, which had obviously been doing the rounds anyway. It was when they'd made the Ridley Scott director's cut of this film, which I'll get into. There was the assembly cut of Alien 3 that, you know, it's very rough looking and Fincher refused to take part, but they've put something together. And there's a supposedly alternate cut of Alien Resurrection that's basically just a new opening credit sequence because they had to do something, I guess. So yeah, there's that and loads of new extra features and documentaries and stuff. So I was, like I say, I was obsessed with it. And since then, I watched Alien now on 4K, which I've upgraded it to, because, you know, you've got to. I've got Alien and Aliens because they're out. And yeah, so in regards to the director's cut situation, I will say the one that I watched and the one that we're going to be reviewing is the 1979 theatrical version. I assume it's the one you two watched as well.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't hold with that director's cut nonsense.
As always, though, I'm interested to hear what the differences are.
Well, I can go into that. The differences are, it's one of those weird situations, by the way, first of all, where the director's cut is actually almost 2 minutes shorter than the theatrical cut. It's not longer, so it couldn't be referred to as an extended cut. And Ridley Scott has gone on...
It's Ridley Scott, so there's a unicorn in there too.
Now, Ridley Scott has gone on file to say that he has no issues whatsoever with the theatrical version, but he also did do the new version, and he says it's an alternate experience, but it's safe to say they're both director's cuts because he's happy with both of them, and it's up to you whichever one you want to watch. I will go into the two major differences. Like I said, they're mostly kind of things like a couple of moving of scenes and some pacing and some alternate shots and stuff. The two major differences are there's a scene when Ash lets them back in with Kane after Ripley has refused to let them in, where Lambert basically goes off on one with Ripley for, you know, we were going to keep us locked out there, and slaps her basically, which is very different for their relationship for the rest of the movie, which is surprising. And the biggest change, it's one of the deleted scenes that became famous, and it's back in the director's cut, is that when Ripley is making her way through the corridors after everyone else has seemingly died and she's going to the shuttle, she encounters Captain Dallas. And he's been cocooned and is basically slowly turning into an alien egg. And the idea is that the alien wouldn't always kill, it would capture. And that's how the life cycle would work. It would capture one of you, you would mutate into an egg, which would then become another facehugger, which would propagate the cycle over and over again. But it's probably a good job that scene was cut, because that kind of negates the idea of a queen that James Cameron introduced in the next movie. Although some people insist that, you know, even though it's a deleted scene, it is canon and the aliens can reproduce both ways. So... make of that what you will, if you weren't already aware of that. Yeah,
I don't think that scene really adds much to me. I think it does slow it down.
It's certainly a stupid time to put it, because it is when Ripley's like running wildly through the corridors, desperately trying to escape and looking for a way, and then it stops the film completely dead for her to be like, oh, let's have a chat with Dallas, who's stuck here, you know, transforming into an egg. But it's such a weird, out there, bizarre concept, and so weird that it's like, I can understand where they came from and why they might, you know, some people might want to put it back, and why the idea is that some people insist on it being a thing with the alien life cycle, you know, even if it's questionably canonical or whatever. So, yeah, I mean, the scene's out there, it's in the director's cut, and it's on deleted scenes and everything if you want to go and watch it, but... like I said, the differences are so minor other than that I just thought, I prefer the theatrical cut anyway, personally. So, we'll not be reviewing the director's cut. It's not bad, it's just it's such so little of a difference that I've explained all the changes already. And, yeah, any thoughts from you two on those changes and the few things we've added?
Not really. I'm really surprised it's shorter.
We're going to get into it a little bit more about our sort of thoughts on the film and the various things we've already introduced. But before we do that, we're going to pass over to a behind-the-scenes section, as we always do. But this is a very special behind-the-scenes, this episode, because we have a bit of a guest who DK and I were very fortunate enough to chat to, a chap called Roger Christian. If you don't know the name, you definitely know his work. He is a production designer, film director, and he was the man responsible for the production design, which won an Academy Award on Star Wars, and the production design on Alien. So we talked to him about those things, and we have some of our chat about Alien to share with you right now as a kind of behind the scenes. So without further ado, I'll cross over to myself and DK interviewing Roger Christian.
Welcome to a special episode of the Silver Screen Podcast. Today, hosts Mike.
Hello.
And me, DK, are thrilled to bring you an exclusive interview with a true legend of the film industry, Roger Christian. As an Academy Award-winning set designer, director and writer, Roger's extraordinary career has left an indelible mark on some of the most iconic films in cinematic history. So join us as we delve into Roger's incredible career, exploring his experiences behind the scenes of some of the most beloved films of all time, from his early days in set design to his ventures into directing and writing. Roger shares fascinating insights and anecdotes that will captivate any film enthusiast. So, without further ado, we'll dive straight into our questions. I hope that's okay with you, Roger?
Yep.
Hello, that's everybody. Great.
Well, basically, how did you come to work for Ridley Scott on Alien? Was he aware of your Star Wars work, or was there an existing relationship there?
No, I directed art directed commercials for Ridley and Tony. I knew very well, so we already kind of friends. And I was on Life of Brian when he hired Michael Seymour and a set decorator to do Alien. And they were started building the rough parts of the set, I was on Life of Brian, and we were about 2 or 3 weeks from driving down to Tunisia to start. And Lord Delfont read the script, who was funding it, and called it blasphemous and cancelled it on the spot. I was with the producer, John Goldstone, in the office in Soho, and an hour later the phone rang and they said, "It's Ridley for you," because there were no cell phones in those days. And he said, "Get your backside down to Shepherd and I need you." So I drove down. They sat me down and said, "Read the script." Gordon Carroll gave it to me and said, "Read the script." And you have to think, I arrived in an office. Ridley was locked on an inner office doing storyboards. They'd locked him in because they needed the whole thing storyboarded. I walk in this office. There are 6 Giga paintings around the wall, originals. And I'm going, "Oh, well, this is going to be something." I read the script and it's like, it reads like you imagine. It's just...
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Straight through. And knowing Ridley and knowing what he was going to do, I said, "I'm in." And they said, "Well, we need you to start right now." And I walked down to meet Michael Seymour, and the set decorator, Ian, came rushing up to me and said, "Oh, thank God you're here. What do I do with all this scrap?" You know, he said, I dip curtains in tea. I make things look old and like beautiful old period films. What do I do?" And so I kind of took over. That Michael had hired some kid who said he could do what I did. He'd never even worked on a film before. And he bought like a jet engine, a few bits of stuff. And I thought, "Oh, this is like 10 times bigger than the Millennium Falcon." And it just happened, Ridley then needed to film Sigourney Weaver for a screen test, because obviously that part, the studio wanted a star and he wanted her. And he said, "Can you put me together a piece of the ship so I can really blow them away what the whole thing is going to look like?" So Michael put his corridor up in the wood frame, and I got a ton more scrap in and went to work. And I told them when I started, "I need my 3 prop boys who I've trained," and they hired those on the spot. And we got to work and stuck in tubing, and I got these special effects boys to make up switch panels. And we built a piece of corridor, which was the alien corridor, basically. The only difference was it had portholes. And then they wanted her to have a gun, so the special effects boys and I, we made a Roger Christian gun out of, you know, a gun, and we stuck sights on it and did it differently to Star Wars, but we made that up. And Ridley got the smoke in and shot the hell out of it, and it just looked amazing. And the only change was those portholes, that it needed to be claustrophobic. So they were eliminated. So there was no outside views on Star Wars, which was a really good thing to have. And that's how it came about, really. And then I got the whole set ready. I had to do the whole of that. And it was built as one. They built 2 big stages at Shepperton. They opened up the doors and it snaked through so that you went in a tiny opening into the set and you were in that ship. You couldn't get out and you had to walk through it. So it you know, and Ridley said to me up front, "Can you make me a space truck, like an army truck?" So I said, yeah. He showed. I remember the screening, he showed Dr. Strangelove, which completely confused everybody. And then he was looking at Michael Seymour and said, Michael, I want the interior like Hair, don't you understand? Michael came running out to me after. He said, what does he mean, Hair? I don't understand. I said, he means switches everywhere, pipes, gritty, grotty stuff. He said, oh, you go and do it. So, it's interesting because when George was digitizing Star Wars for the release of all six films, and I was up at the ranch at that point, and he took me down and showed me and said, digital shows up everything. So from that first movie, you could see gaffer tape around Darth Vader's neck. You could see gold tape on C-3PO. He told me he had to virtually redo all six movies. So, and when Alien was released, there was a six box set on Blu-ray. They sent it to me for some reason to do a commentary and say what I thought. I didn't want to open it for a week because I thought, oh my God, it's all going to show up. I mean, this was built out of crap and airplane junk and everything, but it actually looked still amazing. And I think because of the interior and because Ridley used smoke in the sets, you know, to make a diffusion, it looked amazing. It's a huge relief. Yeah, we got the sets right on Alien, I think.
Cool. I'm going to skip across a few couple of questions because many critics, I think, have noted a sort of underlying current of sexuality or sexualization in at least the first two Alien films, which I know you've talked about before in terms of, you know, the way that they designed the alien eggs and things. But that is echoed in the set design at times. And was that a deliberate brief, like, oh, I must make this look phallic, or is it just like a happy accident? Or...
No, that was... That's if you look at Giga's art, it's a mixture of female and male body parts and kind of mechanics and science and stuff. So he actually designed the egg just with a straight U shape. And that first one that was made, I mean, everyone was standing back going, this is a woman's part. You can't do this. It's exactly the same. And so it was done like a cross to take that away. But, you know, the big alien craft, it's that's what it is. They're all women's parts. And nothing much got changed. I mean, that's the genius of Giga. HR, I mean, and you look at the alien, it's a mixture of male body parts, and I think to me at the time it kind of added to the phobias of a kind of reality of horror, because everything true horror is building on fears that human beings have, fear of the dark, fear of stuff growing inside you, cancers, fear of all of the standard bogeymen, all of that. And that went into the writing of Alien. And so Ridley, seeing Giga's stuff, realized his prayers were answered, because how do you make this work? And, you know, whether people nowadays notice it or not, but it's all there. It's all over Alien, everywhere. And we didn't hide it. We just thought it's just there.
I've read actually a lot about the issues that you faced in the production of Alien, not least by your department. What's the initial feeling like when you find out that the accountants have just taken away a huge chunk of your budget, and does it force you to pivot to other ideas at all?
Despite Star Wars' success, and they then thought, well, a science fiction movie could make it, but this was an R-rated, and there was huge fear this was not ever going to find an audience, so it was... Not long before shooting, they cut 600,000 out of a budget that was only five or six. There is no budget except for the art department. You know, there's no stars in it, nothing. So that was a huge blow. And then, when they're waking up the crew, the lotus leaf going up, that got cut. And we had a Spanish art director, Les and I had hired, and we worked with on Beaugest, the last final remake of Beaugest with Marty Feldman. We brought Benjamin over because he was thought like us. He was brilliant. And we put him to work, and the special effects had some pistons left over. They had those cockpit. They were from plane cockpits. He had enough of those, and he made that set work out of nothing behind the scenes. And that Fox didn't know we did that. And then we were hiding sets from Peter Bill. We still were doing them, you know, and then that, where Michael was clever with Ridley, like that huge, the alien, the big set, which Ridley was saying, we need that scale, you know, and he's the pilot who's holding the weapon. That went out, but Fox were persuaded by Ridley was saying, if we built half of it then on a turntable, we could turn it around and shoot the reverses the other way because the background would be the same. We did that to make that work. And you know, there was quite a few things going on behind the scenes that Fox never knew about. Peter Beale was the controller, you know, and he was always coming down cutting sets. Literally, and then we go behind the scenes and say, all right, we'll do it this way.
Yeah, so some fascinating stuff there, I think you'll agree. And really, thank you so much to Roger for taking the time to chat with us. We will put out a full version of the interview that we had with Roger, full and extended, in which we talk about more about Alien and also about Star Wars and his other short films and things. So please look out for that. We promise you it's a fantastic watch, and we've hopefully whet your appetite with that little bit of information on Alien that we provided you with there. So with that out of the way, then we'll jump into the main sections of our review. I'm going to throw it open to you guys and just say, where do you want to start? And is there anything that particularly stands out? We normally start with writing and plot, but it's up to you guys if you want to do something different.
I'm completely fine to go anyway, mate. I honestly, I think whichever angle you approach this from, it's going to be good stuff.
Yeah, fair enough. Let's see. I do have some information, well, a lot of information that I put under writing that was arguably behind-the-scenes stuff that was excised, but I did want to share it because I think it's fascinating. So if you bear with me, and again, please interrupt if you've got anything to say about this, otherwise it could get very dry, but I just find it all really fascinating about the genesis of the script and how it came together. So I'll start by telling you that Dan O'Bannon had written 29 pages of a script titled Memory, containing what would become the opening scenes of Alien, which was a crew of astronauts awakening to find that their voyage has been interrupted because they're receiving a signal from a mysterious planetoid. They investigate, and their ship breaks down on the surface, as we know. He didn't yet have a clear idea as to what the alien antagonist of the story would be, and he soon accepted an offer to work on Alejandro Jodorowsky's adaptation of Dune, something you know all about, DK.
Yes, and I kind of wish I didn't.
We talk about that, or you talk about that on your Dune review, which again you can find on the channel. So yeah, as you probably know, that project ultimately fell through. Whether or not the version that we got from David Lynch is better, let's leave up to history. But in either way, it introduced him to several artists whose work gave him ideas for a sci-fi story, including Chris Foss, H.R. Giger, and Sean Mobius Giraud. O'Bannon was impressed by Foss's covers for sci-fi books, and he found Geiger's work disturbing, saying, I'd never seen anything that was quite as horrible and at the same time as beautiful as his work, and so I ended up writing a script about a Geiger monster. Do you guys have any information about H.R. Geiger, anything you want to share about the creature design?
I've always kind of had a love-hate relationship with the guy. So, That's about it for me.
It's very weird, and I mean, if you haven't had a chance to look it up, I think it's called Necronomicon 4, the original inspiration for the alien, which looks basically like a xenomorph. But he's fascinated with all this idea of, like, sexual perversion and the melding of machine and organic life and everything, and his work is super-duper weird. Are you aware of any of this, Sandra, or is this all new to you?
I wasn't, but one of the things I was going to comment on is how, you know, every time you saw something, a coil or a cord or a wire, it always looked like it could be the alien right behind, you know, one of our characters, and how you know, the fact that the alien did have those appendages that looked like parts of the ship lent itself to this environment, to the scariness. Something I did notice.
It's something they kind of, I would say, maybe have leaned away from, but there's definitely seems to be more of a biomechanical aspect to this one, as you said, because it kind of it blends in with the background parts of the ship and stuff, as you said. So there's something weird about it, I think, that's it tickles something kind of revolting and yet intriguing in our brains. Anyway, moving on. Ronald Shusett suggested that O'Bannon use one of his other film ideas. He was the other writer. His idea was about gremlins infiltrating a B-17 bomber during World War II. He set that on the spaceship as the second half of his memory story. The working title of the project was now, as you probably know, Star Beast. I think that's quite famously known. But O'Bannon disliked this and changed it to Alien because he noted the number of times that word appeared in the script. And both men liked the new title's simplicity and the double meaning as both a noun and an adjective. So, yeah, I can't disagree with that. I think that works quite well. It was Shusett who came up with the idea that one of the crew members could be implanted with an alien embryo that would burst out of him. He thought it would be an interesting plot device by which the alien could get aboard the ship. Excuse me. Screenwriter Ron Shusett stated, and I quote, Dan O'Bannon put his finger on the problem. What has to happen next is the creature has to get on the ship in an interesting way. I have no idea how, but if we could solve that, if it can't be that it just snuck in, despite what Sandra thinks, then I think the whole movie will come into place. In the middle of the night, I woke up and I said, Dan, I think I have an idea. The alien screws one of them. It jumps on his face and plants its seed. And Dan said, oh my God, we've got it. We've got the whole movie. I love that. That sounds like the most film executive conversation you could probably have. Dan, the alien screws someone. Oh, go picture. Genius.
Print.
Cut print, done. And that is arguably the most famous scene in the film. So the idea that it came kind of quite late on is something that fascinated me as well. In writing the script, though, O'Bannon drew inspiration from many previous works of sci-fi and horror.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
It has stated, I didn't steal Alien from anybody. I stole it from everybody.
Yeah. Didn't the acid blood come about in kind of that same sort of fashion? Basically, figure out a reason why they don't just shoot the thing, why they don't just blast it here in the beginning of the movie when they first see it. And then I don't know if it was Bannon, but he was like, acid blood. And he's like, yes, that's it. That's great.
That's great. Now can it screw one of them? No, I do like that. I love that they actually make a point of that in the film where they say, like, it's the perfect defense mechanism because you don't dare kill it. Otherwise, you're screwed, basically. But yeah. So anyway, DK, I believe I've got a second part of writing information that you have to read out.
I do, yeah. Shusett and O'Bannon presented their script to several studios, pitching it as Jaws in Space. A friend passed the script on to Gordon Carroll, David Giler and Walter Hill, who'd formed a production company called Brandywine, who had ties to 20th Century Fox. Hill and Giler were not fully satisfied with the script and made numerous rewrites and revisions. This caused tension with O'Bannon and Shusett, since Hill and Giler had very little experience with science fiction, according to Shusett. He said they weren't good at making it better, or in fact, at not making it even worse. O'Bannon believed that Hill and Giler were attempting to justify taking his name off the script and claiming Shusett and his work as their own. I know some people like that. Hill and Giler did add some substantial elements to the story, including the android character Ash, which O'Bannon felt was an unnecessary subplot, but which Shusett later described as one of the best things in the movie. That whole idea and scenario was theirs. Hill and Gyla went through 8 drafts of the script in total. They concentrated largely on the Ash subplot, but also making the dialogue more natural and trimming some sequences set on the alien planetoid. Despite the fact that the final shooting script was written by Hill and Gyla, the Writers Guild of America awarded O'Bannon sole credit for the screenplay. And at the end of the film, Ridley Scott had wanted the alien to bite off Ripley's head and then make the final log entry in her voice. Yeah, Jesus Christ, the more I know about this guy, the more I want to just slap him. But the producers vetoed this idea. They believed the alien should die at the end of the film. Hallelujah. Yeah.
Oh, well, I won't get into the ending where the alien makes a log entry, then a unicorn appears made out of origami, then.
Yeah, yeah. And then you find out that the alien was a replicant all along.
Weirdly enough, that brings me to what I was going to discuss, because we're going to have to talk about the various bits of the writing and the plot. And the thing that stood out in a lot of the sort of things you mentioned there and kind of stands out to me as something we should discuss is the Ash plot. Like, how do you guys feel about it? Because I noticed more so this time watching the film that, like, They definitely seem to have kept the fact that he's an android. Seem to have kept the fact he's an android as a secret from the crew. And he acts human in every way. He goes into cryosleep when there's no need. He wears a mask. He sits and drinks milk and eats food with them and everything. And I'm like, it's weird because in all of the other films of the franchise, they are openly aware that, you know, androids exist and they're with them. So what do you think about this whole Ash idea and how does it hit you?
No, I was just going to say, I do like it. I think it is a very important subplot to the movie, and I think the film would be a lot poorer without it. And I think if it had not been such a good actor like Ian Holm, it may not have worked. But the two are inseparable, the subplot and the main plot. I can't fault it.
Fair enough. What about you, Sandy? Any thoughts initially on
it? Yeah, I really did like the Ash subplot, and you can definitely pick up, you know, in subsequent watches, you can pick up on the foreshadowing, some things that he says.
Oh, and the way he acts, I mean, it's suspicious even the first time you watch the movie, but when you know what he's doing and you can actually look at him, like, turning off the screen because it's showing the alien embryo, you know, in X-ray, so he's, you know, turning it off and shooing Ripley away from it and stuff, and he's the one, you know, insisting on going down, and the one telling Ripley there's no point in telling them, it's a warning, you know, by the time you get there they'll find out anyway. You know, it's him that lets them in, which in that beautiful kind of scene where it's like, is he being nice to them or is it more to do with the fact that he just wants the life form in there, you know? So,
and it's cool that there's not just one villain to overcome.
Yeah, it reconceptualizes a lot of his actions and a lot of the movie, and it gives logical reason for it to happen as opposed to just they were really dumb. Which, you know, there's still a bit of that. I mean, we mock kind of, you know, Prometheus, Alien Covenant and stuff, but I still groan in this movie when John Hurt's like, oh, look, I can see something inside the egg. Let's pop my head directly down into it. That'll help. You literally saw it with the UV light. You know there's something in there. What do you think's going to happen, man? Honestly.
That your helmet's going to protect you. That's what you think.
You still wouldn't take the risk. I mean, you could understand him looking or being a little bit curious, but the way he's just literally head straight down into the egg, you know, like, dude, come on, have a little bit of caution.
It's that human curiosity. We think cats are the curious ones, but we're the ones that are self-destructive with that curiosity.
Jonesy was safe.
And it's all our curiosity that is our downfall.
Often, yeah, although there's a lot more at play here, and as I said, we touched on it already, and if you don't know this, you know, where have you been? But obviously it's all about, you know, the corporation, the idea that they want this life form as a weapon, or they want it for some kind of gain, and we are all expendable in the hands of the money people, or corporate greed, or whatever you want to call it. And that's kind of where Ash's plot comes in, which leads me to kind of ask the question, do you think Ash really needed to be an android, or could he not have just been like a company man? Would that have been as effective, or did you think, you know what, because I still watching this movie, I'm like, I get the idea of it, and obviously it's become a staple of the franchise, and let's be honest, it's become a staple of Ridley Scott, who just ran with this idea. But I still watching it back, I'm just kind of like, it kind of comes out of nowhere that it's like, oh, he's a damn robot,
you know, like, I think that's why it's so effective. Because you would have been so blindsided by this in the cinema at the time. Yeah, they could have made him a normal person, but, you know, where's the fun in that? You know, you've got to have some, you know, attempted porn magazine oral rape, and you know, you've got to have somebody's head knocked off with an extinguisher and bloody milk.
Yeah.
I just think that I wish I'd have been there in a cinema audience,
yeah,
to see the reaction to this, because I just think it just comes so out of the blue. And yes, you could have, you know, as you said, had a company man, but you're not, it's not going to be anywhere near as shocking. And for a horror movie, that's the way you're going to go.
I don't know if I would agree that it's not as shocking, because I think it is as shocking in Aliens when it subverts it, and it is the company man that's evil and the android that's actually on her side. So, yeah. But then again, I am predisposed to prefer that.
I think it was necessary for him to be an android, because to break that quarantine protocol, in the instance of the whole reason the quarantine protocol is in place, he had to have not really been in fear of losing his own life.
That's a very good point. And I suppose it does, it feeds into another thing, which isn't, it's there in this movie, but it's not quite as, you know, as big of a deal as it would become in other Alien movies and other Ridley Scott movies, which is the idea of, like, you can't trust artificial intelligence. You know, they get an order and it's like, human life's expendable, doesn't matter. Before I forget, by the way, yes, again, there's so much kind of weird phallic and sexual imagery in this film, and we wouldn't be the first podcast or examination of it to go into the fact that that's kind of what the horror of it all plays with. And the reason I bring that up is that there's a reason why the computer is called Mother. it's playing into these themes all the same way, you know, the maternal figure who is actually out to kill you, which is part of the fear, along with, you know, as you said, the face hugger is a terrible kind of a fear of how men view kind of pregnancy, you know, as a weakening, and the way you can be violated and have this thing living within you. And it supposedly plays, and I think it kind of does, into these kind of primal fears of, like, something we'll never experience, but we're terrified of. And, you know, again, we discussed it a little bit with Roger Christian, and it's been said millions of times, but yeah, there's something incredibly phallic about so much of the facehugger, the xenomorph, the vaginal entries to the engineer spaceship. You know, there's just incredible amounts of phallic imagery here, because, well, it's an HR geek project for a start. And I do love that story that Roger shared, by the way, that he was making so many phallic things, and then the studio complained that the eggs looked too phallic. So he changed the opening of the egg to a Christian cross, supposedly. He said, you can't possibly have a problem with that. You all love the cross so much. This is why it looks like that. So it's like, oh, what? Okay, whatever. But yeah, so that's where a lot of the horror comes from. It's not just, you know, the monster or the other. I think it plays into that. Oh, that's certainly my analysis. And as a film geek who's kind of studied this on the, you know, arterial level and on that readings level, that's something I see a lot of. But, you know, you guys, I'm assuming, don't necessarily have that baggage. So do you kind of see any of this, or is it kind of new to you, or do you just disagree maybe that it's any of that?
I fully agree with it. And I think it uses it as a kind of horror trope in this way, to kind of, I don't know, shock the males in the audience, which I think, you know, if obviously if you get a certain subsection who are going to be very dismissive of, you know, sexual violence and things like that. And I think putting it in a it's doing the old Roddenberry trick, isn't it? It's putting it as in like a kind of science fiction setting.
Yeah.
And, you know, addressing the issue. And I'm sure, you know, we say this so often now, it's like banging our heads against the wall, but the fact that if you release this today, it would just be cancelled for, you know, being woke kind of thing. You know, it's got a female lead, nobody listens to her, she's the only survivor, it's got all this phallic imagery, it's very much based on sexual violence and stuff like that.
Yes,
you're going to have a certain subsection just railing for this to be boycotted. And yeah, so that's my take. I'm fully on board with it.
Before I forget to say this, related to that as well, talking about, like, it would be cancelled nowadays and things that just went under the radar. In the sequel Aliens, I don't know if you guys know this, it's confirmed on a crew screen that the character of Lambert is trans. It points out that they were born male and had gender surgery, and it's kind of like, oh, there's no psychological effects from this or whatever. And it's incredible to me that this passed by completely unnoticed. Nobody blinked an eye back in the sort of 70s.
I never knew that.
Yeah. It's in when Burke's kind of interviewing Ripley and talking about, like, you blew up $1 million spacecraft or whatever.
And it's got crew bios in the background.
There's crew bios in the background. And I'm just kind of like, that's incredible to me that nobody even noticed, let alone cared.
No idea. My mind is blown.
But I mean, it feeds into the idea that, like you said, this is kind of all about, like, fears of kind of different kinds of sexuality and the ways these can be done. And when you look at it as kind of, you know, aggressive violence towards a trans woman, there's a whole other level of, like, oh shit, this is prevalent. This suddenly becomes a lot more, oh dear, dealing with things we're seeing a lot of these days.
I will say that when I found out about facehuggers, when I was very, you know, in that period when I was very young and I had this, you know, movie described to me and then ended up, I guess, seeing it, for months afterwards, I would try and sleep under the covers simply because I did not want a facehugger on me when I was asleep.
Yeah, I can see what you mean. I mean, the facehuggers as a concept are scary because, like you said, they are the initial idea of, like, it's violation, it's kind of rape, it's, you know, they're forcing the reproductive thing onto you and they're latching on, they're not letting go. But related to that as well, I mean, you can kind of see it in the Xenomorph's design. Like, its head is basically one giant penis and it's penetrating you with a phallic appendage with the whole second inner mouth thing. It's like the subtext is rapidly becoming text at this point, you know? It's not subtle. And, you know, if you disagree, fair enough. But I think it's safe to say that, yeah, there's a lot there that you can't really deny the point of. So what about you, Sandy? Did you pick up on any of this stuff? Is any of it new to you, or how do you feel about this?
I think I had heard that before, or maybe when we talked about it during Prometheus, but I didn't, except for the violation. That's very much very obvious. And it's, you know, what the movie makes you feel. The horror of that, but the there being a lot of phallic things in your face, so to speak, I didn't really pick up on that.
That's fair enough. I think if I was to argue that, you know, even if you don't necessarily agree with it, I think it works on a kind of subconscious level. I think more so arguably with the men in the audience, which I think is maybe why this is more of an effective. Because, like I said, it's things that men supposedly, I mean, going back even to Freud, they secretly fear, you know, penetration or attacks by men and subjugation by women that they secretly desire but revolted by and blah, blah, blah. We've exhausted, I think, talking about the writing, so I will move to the direction because I think, DK.
I've got something here. O'Bannon, he had originally assumed that he'd direct, but 20th Century Fox instead asked Hill, who declined due to other film commitments, as well as not being comfortable with the level of visual effects that would be required. Peter Yates, John Boorman, Jack Clayton, Robert Aldrich and Robert Altman were considered for the task, but O'Bannon, Schuster and the Brandywine team felt that these directors would not take the film seriously and would instead treat it as a B-model.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Monster movie. Gyla Hill and Carol have been impressed by Ridley Scott's debut feature film, The Duelists, and made an offer for him to direct Alien, which Scott quickly accepted. He created detailed storyboards for the film in London, which impressed Fox enough to double the film's budget. His storyboards included designs for the spaceship and spacesuits, drawing on such films as 2001, A Space Odyssey and Star Wars. However, he was keen on emphasising horror in Alien rather than fantasy, describing the film as the Texas Chainsaw Massacre of science fiction. I do have to say that's interesting. I've often heard of Alien being the Rolling Stones to the Star Wars Beatles. It's a nasty Star Wars.
Hmm. I can see where you're coming from. And like I said, the fact that the chair's a production designer, I think, is telling. Yeah. And people have said, you know, people have said that the inspiration there was that Star Wars wasn't the shiny, clean vision of the future. It was lived in and everything. And, you know, you can't underestimate the impact that had, along with the idea of, like you said, space truckers, you know, random guys all sitting here smoking, complaining about not getting their cut of the bonuses. And, you know, I mean, if it wasn't for the backdrop that they're sitting in, this could be a scene from, you know, at any 1970s trucker kind of thing. Like I said, it could be people sit at a truck stop talking about hauling any kind of crap, you know, but it's mineral ore in space. So, you know, but yeah. Anyway, talking about the direction, as I said, we were going to come back to it. So, yeah, I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but Ridley Scott really was a bit coy when it came to the chestburster scene. There was a rumor going around that he didn't tell anybody it was coming, which has since been debunked. He did show them the chestburster puppet and did say that it was going to go popping out of John Hurt and that was what was going to happen, but didn't quite explain the, let's see, intensity that was going to be coming out. So the reaction of Veronica Cartwright when she gets sprayed with blood from the kind of effect hose is genuine. She did not know that was going to happen. supposedly everybody was really freaked out by how well the scene was played and how intense it was, and the, like I said, shock value of not knowing when it would happen. Ridley Scott chose not to show the full alien for most of the film, keeping most of its body in shadow to create a sense of terror and heightened suspense. Insert Shua Jan gif. It certainly wasn't because the costume looked shocking if you actually saw it in full light. But anyway, the audience could thus project their own fears into imagining what the rest of the creature might look like. Every movement is going to be very slow, very graceful, and the alien will alter shape, so you never really know exactly what he looks like, Scott said. He's also quoted as saying, I've never liked horror films before, because in the end, it's always been a man in a rubber suit. Well, there's one way to deal with that. The most important thing in a film of this type is not what you see, but the effect of what you think you saw. I arguably not quite as effective for me as I think a lot of people take it. I take umbrage with that, but you know, your mileage may vary. And just as a final little bit of random amusing story, the light effects in the egg chamber were created by lasers borrowed from English rock band The Who. The band was testing the lasers for use in their stage show on the sound stage next door and let the production use them. So those lasers that John Hurt slips through, you would have seen them at The Who show if you'd been there in the 70s.
Well, he did die before he got old.
Oh, good God. Oh, that's staying in. That's just too good of a pun not to. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the stuff we have about the direction, the kind of cold analysis of it. Like I said, to jump in with my own kind of editorializing, I don't think Scott's idea of like, oh, it's about what you don't see and it's all in shadow, and I don't think that works for me. I find it incredibly frustrating, and I'd rather just see what the fuck's happening, to be perfectly honest. But I know that's a very, very unpopular opinion among fans of the movie. So I'm going to throw it open to you two, which are presumably disagree, and give you know your view on that and why I'm wrong.
I do like it because, you know, you're a fan of Doctor Who, mate. You know that often what your mind, especially when you're younger, what your mind makes up is infinitely more terrifying than what you see on screen. So I think it works to an extent. Although he does push the envelope at times with, I mean, you mentioned it earlier, I think prior to recording, the whole, you know, toying with Lambert. You do think, oh, all right now, all right, you know, either, you know, shit, I'll get off the pot kind of thing, Ridley.
I don't know what's happening in that scene, and it's frustrating because it's a key scene. It's the death of Lambert and Parker. And yet I've got no clue how they died or what happened because you can't bloody see it. It's just like, well, you know, give me something. Like, I agree that it's effective if it's, like, hiding in the vents and the way that it, like, there's some fantastic stuff. The scene where it pops out at Dallas, and you don't even see anything. It's just, like, it's dark for a minute, and then just, it dives at him. That kind of thing's amazing. Really effective, yeah. Like, I like all that. You know, it's hiding in vents, it's in shadows, it makes sense. And the stuff that Sandra said, where it's, like, you're never sure if any coil that you're looking at is a piece of rubber hose machinery or the alien. But then when it's actually attacking, you know, crew members and killing them, I'd like to see what's happening so I at least know.
Well, you know, like we said, like, you know, like we refer back to, it's the Texas Chainsaw Massacre in space, and he's kind of employing the same techniques that they did in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It flashes, so it gives you some idea of what might be happening, and then it cuts away and lets your mind fill in the rest, which is, you know, the way to go. It's You know, it worked in Texas Chainsaw Massacre. I mean, you know, as you said, your mileage may vary, but I honestly, for the most part, I think it works. And I'm not saying that it, you know, blow smoke up Ridley Scott's ass, because you know how I feel about Ridley Scott. So, yeah, I do think it works to an extent in this. I do think, and it might be because over the years you've gained a huge appreciation for horror movies and some of the stuff you've seen, and I've seen some of the stuff you've seen, mate. And frankly, you're a sick bastard. But it's
you showed me half of it. I learned it from watching you.
But what I'm saying is, you know, you've become desensitized to it. So now you're looking at it from that kind of thing and just saying, well, you could have shown something. It wouldn't have made that much of a difference. But again, put yourself back to at that point in cinematic history, and I think it's incredibly effective.
I see what you're saying, and I agree, but I don't necessarily think it's even about just desensitization from horror. I think it's because I've seen the other Alien films, and in particular the sequel, and I think what James Cameron is able to deliver that you actually see compared to what you actually don't see in this film, for me, is more effective. And again, I know it isn't for everyone. Some people claim, oh, it's better when it's off screen and it's your mind's doing the tricks and it's more of a haunted house atmosphere as opposed to a, you know, balls to the wall action film. But for me, I prefer the way that the sequel handles it. And I think, you know, the argument that it wouldn't have looked good kind of falls apart, because there's things here where it does work, like the scenes where it's kind of, you don't know where the alien is and it's kind of propelled up in the rafters hanging like a gymnast kind of coming down on them, or the entire kind of attack in the shuttle where you can see everything perfectly clearly and it doesn't look shocking, you know.
But I think if it had tipped his hand earlier on in the film, those moments, especially, you know, in the Narcissus, it wouldn't have been as shocking, if you know what I mean.
And
I did think it worked for me, because especially in the end when the mother alien comes out, and we find that it's in the shuttle with Ripley, my mind was able to fill in enough, even though there was a lot of steam and it was dark. My mind was able to conjure really be freaked out by it. But what's really cool is that he gave us everything in regards to the facehugger, because when we saw it opened up and, we were looking at its anatomy, and it looked just like biology class and things I've dissected. I could see, I was like, that's the liver, you know. I mean, it was just very, very just descriptive. He gave us everything with that part.
I get that, but I think I'm just so fascinated by the xenomorph and kind of love the creature itself that I'd like to have seen more of. Like you don't even really get to see it use its pharyngeal jaw, which is such a cool concept, and it's like you see it, but it's in such vague sense and such shadow that you're like, what's going on? Which again, I think probably adds to the whole, you know, fear of the penetration, you don't know what it is kind of thing. But I could have done with a little bit more, because I just like seeing these things. But anyway, that makes me sound really weird.
Again, not to bang on the same drum, it just interests me that he approached it from a feeling of, oh, less is more. And, you know, we'll just have glimpses and then we'll go away from it, because we want the audience's mind to do somersaults, basically. And then he came back to do Prometheus and said, look, here's everything laid bare.
And in reality, it was probably a budgetary thing.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it definitely was as well. Like I said, I think there was certainly a degree where they thought the suit for the alien looked shocking. And in certain lights and things, it really does. I mean, I've seen behind-the-scenes photographs of the actor, God bless him, Bolin Badejo, I think, the unsung hero who wears the suit. And it's kind of like, it looks like something from the 60s Twilight Zone. It's not convincing at all, yeah.
Oh, dude, I mean, you know, we watched a malicious Bertie Bassett on Doctor Who. So it's... You know, I take it as I find it, and I honestly still think it kind of holds up. Mind you, I honestly do think the Bertie Bassett holds up too, so there you go.
There you go. But no, on the subject, I did I didn't write this in my notes, but on the subject that you were talking about, Sandra, one of the things that I found out about the film in prepping for the podcast is that not a great film for vegetarians or vegans, because that actually is all animal innards in the kind of facehugger and all the scenes where they're dealing with parts and things. Those aren't special effects.
That's interesting. I didn't know that, but it was recognizable, all those parts.
I think your brain does recognize it, and it kind of, it adds to how disgusting it is, because you can't fake that. No matter how good your special effects are, you know, there's something to having actual, like, I don't know, frog look. Did you guys have any other thoughts on the direction before I move us along?
I love the use of light in this, and
it's one thing I don't love.
Again, it's going back to the less is more, but I do think it works.
And some parts were very Kubrick-esque my thought. And I did like, I know what you're talking about. Yeah, I did like it. And it, you mentioned, you know, the claustrophobic feeling that was with the camera angles and everything that was achieved through that direction. So good.
I think it's one of those things where it's, again, your mileage is going to vary and it'll depend on a lot of factors. Like, I find it frustrating because I want to see more of the creature. And I think there's a certain generation of film fans who just don't like things like that. Because it's like, every time I bring up Batman 89 as a work of art, my dad's like, well, I can't see it, it's all in the dark. And I mentioned to my mum, who loves the Alien franchise, that I was reviewing Alien. And she was like, okay, my final primary takeaway from it is somebody should have turned on the bloody light. It would have been nice to see something. So there is a, you know, it's a... It's anecdotal, but there are people that just don't love the lighting in this movie, which gives me kind of at least some gratification that I'm like, all right, it's not just me. Because, yeah, I do think the lighting and cinematography, I think, is shocking for a film as popular and kind of classic as this. I think there are scenes that could and should look absolutely gorgeous, but you just can't see it. And it's ridiculous. Like, I found a picture randomly when I was looking up, you know, the movie of the alien attacking Lambert. And it's so clear. It's clear as day, and it's beautiful, and it makes a fantastic shot. And then you compare it to what you actually saw in the film, and it's just like, why? Why have you obscured and ruined these fantastic things that you had, you know? But again, I think it's a matter of taste. Some people prefer that because they want them, you know, their mind doing the work, filling in the gaps, whatever. So, yeah.
I do think his direction of the people is really good, too, because they do... It doesn't feel like a science fiction movie. Everybody does feel natural. And even though Lambert is a bit hysterical at times, Ripley's always, she's just a very good on-screen female in this era where she's not hysterical. Her scenes where she's frightened, she's never like, boohooing and crying in tears. I know we have one of each there on screen, but I just appreciated his direction of the people also.
Yeah, I think a lot of that is not just down to the direction, it's the people doing the performance, which is the next section I'm going to go into, which is the acting. So if you just bear with me, I have a little bit of information, which is to say that O'Bannon had focused on writing the alien first, putting off developing the other characters. Shusett and he had intentionally written all the roles generically. They made a note in the script that explicitly states the crew is unisex and all parts are interchangeable for men or women. So, yeah, this freed Scott, Selway and Goldberg to interpret the characters as they pleased and to cast accordingly. They wanted the Nostromo's crew to resemble working astronauts in a realistic environment, a concept that, as I said, was summarized as truckers in space. So, yeah, fascinating that they didn't really have any genders or anything in mind for them. It was just anything, plug and play, you know, so that's cool.
Woke.
Oh, no, infected by the woke mind virus. Anyway, so, yeah, I mean, there's only really, like, seven main people, maybe an additional two in the acting to talk about. So we probably don't have to spend very long on it. But what are your highlights of the acting? What stands out and who would be your MVP? Sandy, I'll come to you first.
Oh, my MVP. I mean, oof. Between Hurt and Sigourney Weaver. Oh, man. I mean, it's better just to say the only one I didn't appreciate was Lambert because she was so hysterical. But everybody else was very good in playing their roles. And even we didn't get a lot of.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. and listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Character development, and this is what you said, they have the actors themselves kind of brought their characterization with how they played each character.
Yeah, I think I've made a note that there's a realism. They feel real, and that's the way it's portrayed. It's not like a performance. It's just like, you know, they are these characters doing everyday things, and that's what I appreciate about things like the conversation about bonuses and the day-to-day, you know, monotony and drudge of, oh, we're going back to the Freezerinos, let's have something to eat, oh, the food sucks, and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's just, it's nice to see, to feel more in that world, and I think it adds to the horror because you don't feel like you're watching something fake. But I will have to see it just to you know, give an interest of, in the interest of fairness, just to disagree. I really liked Veronica Cartwright in this. I think I preferred her as Lambert to what you were thinking, because I just like the fact that that's genuinely how I would react to this situation. Like, I can't super relate to all of the stoic, like, don't worry about it, we'll get it, we'll go in the air ducts. Like, I'm sorry, I'd be screaming hysterically in the corner. Like, this thing bleeds acid, it hides anywhere you want it to, it's killed numerous ship members. I'm sorry, I'm basically going to be sitting there going, I'm taking the shuttle, you do what the fuck you want.
And I'm very much Ripley, like trying to stop it the entire time with logic.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that as well. I did like the way that Ripley stood up to Parker and just shouts him down because she's of a higher rank, and you've kind of seen that the engineer types are disgruntled, to say the least. So
I like when she closes that bulkhead, just get him to stop so that he has to turn around and listen to her.
Yes, yeah, exactly. No, I like all of the characterization, but I don't see that one as worse than the other. But I do think that's where the decision to cut that scene that I mentioned in the director's cut kind of hurts the characterization, because you have to remember Lambert was with them on the planet when all of this shit went down. And then she thought she was going to be left outside, you know, because Ripley wouldn't let them back in for the quarantine thing. So as far as she's concerned, like, Ripley's heartless and they're all as expendable as you know, Ash made them seem. So naturally, she's kind of like, nobody gives a crap about our lives and we're about to die horribly. So, yeah, I think that's one thing I would have appreciated. And again, it aids the dynamic between Lambert and Ripley when you know that Lambert stood up to her and slapped her. Like, oh, you heartless bitch, you were just going to leave us out there to die. You know? So anyway, yeah. What about you, DK? Any thoughts on the actor?
MVP-wise, Brett. I mean, come on, man. It's Harry Dean Stanton.
Right.
I just love the guy. And he is the epitome of that down to earth. He's just a guy doing a job.
I mean, I think they're all good. Yeah. It's, like I said, for the same reason I said they're all good, because of the realism. But I do think, like you said, Ian Holm, I have to give a special shout out, because the way he acts shady and you're never trusting him even before you know what's going on. And then the sheer turn into, I guess, kind of mega villain when he's like, oh, one last word.
Ian Holm is, he, I mean, you know, God rest his soul, he was an amazing character actor. And I don't think he got the recognition that he deserved.
I think Bilbo Baggins helped, to be fair to him.
Well, yeah, but I'm just saying, you look at this and you look at him in, you know, say, From Hell and Lord of the Rings and Fifth Element, and they're completely different characters, all of them. And he really was a chameleon. And, so sad he's gone, because he was a great actor.
He's got range as well, like I said, when you look at what he does, even in just this one film, between thinking he's human to now thinking he's shady to the reveal of the android. I mean, that's range. Yeah, I have to shout him up. But other than that, I think they are all great. And as I said already, my other MVP would be Bolaji Badejo, who plays the alien, who sadly passed away in the 90s. Didn't do anything else in Hollywood. Went back home to his home country after this movie. But the way he, you know, he's endured that suit for hours on end and was up in ducts and hanging from stuff. And, you know, all of the creepy movements and stuff of the alien are him. It's his physicality. So I don't think you can really look past him as an unsung hero of the film either. So, yeah. Any other thoughts on the acting until I move?
It's one of those that, you know, it's a small cast, so you can't really go wrong. But there's not and I know you're not huge on Veronica Cartwright in this, but there's not one.
I am. She's not.
Oh yeah, it's Sandy. There's not one that gives a duff performance to me. I just think they're all really believable. You know, they inhabit those characters extremely well. I've got no fault with any of them.
Yeah, I have to agree. Fair enough. Anything, Sandy, or can I move to the next bit?
Yeah, nothing more.
Cool. I only have one note about the FX production design, because obviously we've talked to Roger in the BTS about that, but I did note something that I didn't know, is that although the alien design was by H.R. Giger, it was Carlo Rambaldi who sculpted the head and the jaw, which is now apparently on display at the Smithsonian Museum. So if you wanted to go down there, if you're nearby, you can see the alien head and skull. And something that's fascinating, which brother actually...
Wait a minute. They really missed a trick doing Night at the Museum 2 then, if that's there.
Oh, it's there. It's
in the... Forget Al Capone. Get the goddamn xenomorph involved.
But it's only a head. It's limited in what it can do, really.
Well, somebody could have been carrying it under their arm.
Now I want to see that film. Yeah. But yeah, as I said, something my brother noticed about, of all things, in his Alien Funko Pop, he was fascinated by the fact that you can actually see eyes, because you really can't anywhere in the film, or any of the films really, on the xenomorph. But I have to say, there is apparently an actual human skull underneath. So yeah, there are eyes there.
I read that, and they did release like an alien, an action figure at the time in the late 70s, and that had the eyes also.
Mm. Fair enough. So yeah, they are there. So if you think you've glimpsed them, I think that, again, that adds to the horror, because there's a chance you may have, or you may just have this subconscious awareness that they're there. But yeah, that's fair enough. The music and sound, again, I only really have one note. Obviously, we know it's a Jerry Goldsmith score, the late great, you know, man who did lots of Trek stuff and everything as well. He did provide all of the music, but he didn't really edit it all together. And he didn't like that they used cues taken from some of his previous work, including his work on a movie about Freud, which he didn't like that they used. But again, which arguably adds to the whole idea of, you know, it was probably designed to invoke sexual fetishization and weirdness and all of these things, which it arguably does. But yeah, Goldsmith, not a fan of the use of that, apparently.
I did have this soundtrack on vinyl. And I would play this so much that, you know, the main theme that... Just beautiful.
Cool. So, yeah, I'll move to the next bit. As I said, this being a Cinema Classics podcast, we tend to forego the usual audience response because, you know, they're Cinema Classics, it would be assumed that it would mostly be positive. And I'm always more interested in what the critics made of this movie at the time and, you know, retrospectively. So to that end, I'm going to throw us to the critics' response to this movie. And tell you that Alien was actually met with mixed reviews on release, but it was a box office success. It won the Academy Award for Best Visual Effects, 3 Saturn Awards for Best Sci-Fi Film, Best Direction for Scott, and Best Supporting Actress for Cartwright. So stuff it, Sandy. and got a Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation. Some critics who weren't usually favourable towards science fiction, like Barry Norman, the late great of the BBC's film series, were positive about the film's merits. Others, however, were not. Reviews by Variety, Sight and Sound, Vincent Canby, and Leonard Maltin were all mixed or negative, though Maltin reversed his opinion when the director's cut came out. A review by Time Out said the film was an empty bag of tricks whose production values and expensive trickery cannot disguise imaginative poverty. In their original review on sneak previews, critics Gene Siskel and Roger Ebert gave the film 2 yes votes. Ebert called it one of the scariest old-fashioned space operas I can remember. Siskel agreed that it was scary, but said it was basically a haunted house film set in a spaceship and was not the greatest science fiction film ever made. Siskel gave the film 3 stars out of 4 in his original print review, calling it an accomplished piece of scary entertainment and praising Sigourney Weaver as an actress who should become a major star. Quite foreshadowing there. But listed among the film's disappointments that, for me, the final shape of the alien was the least scary of its forms. Okay. Critical reassessment since then has resulted in Alien being widely considered one of the greatest and most influential science fiction and horror films of all time. In 2002, get ready for your drinks, people, Alien was deemed culturally, historically, or authentically significant by the Library of Congress and was selected for preservation in the US National Film Registry. That's literally got to be the last 20 films in a row, I think, we've had to say that. So, yeah. In 2008, it was ranked by the American Film Institute as the 7th best film in the science fiction genre and as the 33rd greatest film of all time by Empire. The success of Alien spawned a media franchise of films, books, video games, and toys, and propelled Weaver's acting career, The story of her character's encounters with the alien creatures became the thematic and narrative core of the sequels Aliens, Alien 3, and Alien Resurrection. A crossover with the Predator franchise produced the Alien vs. Predator films, while the two-film prequel series was directed by Scott before the upcoming film Alien Romulus, which is actually set between this film and the sequel Aliens. And we'll see what that's like when we get to it, I suppose.
I have one more bit of feedback, which I got from the internet, if you don't mind.
Go for it, yeah.
You've probably seen this, but Alien is a movie where nobody listens to the smart woman, and then they all die except for the smart woman and her cat. 4 stars.
We just have to wrap things up then with our kind of favourite things and our conclusions. So we start, as always, with our favourite character moment and line in the movie. So we'll go around one by one, and Sandy, what was your favourite character, or who was your favourite character, I should say, in the movie?
Ripley was really my favourite character, but she was over the entire thing. My favourite second character was Ash, just because he was so devious. He knew what was happening the entire time. Even from when he had the embryo of the alien up on the screen and lied and said he had no idea what he was looking at. And I think he's the one, the villain that added that extra layer. And so he's really kind of shines as my favorite character.
Cool. What about you, GK?
I've already mentioned it. It's Brett, just because it's Harry.
Right. Yeah, similar to Sandy, I think your favourite character doesn't necessarily have to mean the best character or the one that you want to win or the one that you relate to the most. So my favourite character, in terms of the one that I kind of want to see more of, was actually the alien, the xenomorph. Because like I said, I always wanted to see more of it. And when it wasn't on screen, I was kind of like, you know, where's the alien? So it was the thing that fascinated me most. And because I felt like seeing Ripley would be too obvious. And frankly, I think Weaver gives a better performance in basically all the sequels, even the films that are terrible compared to this one, which is still good. But I think, you know, you look at Aliens, Alien 3, even Alien Resurrection, and I think they're better performances. So, yeah. So what was your favorite moment or scene, Sandy?
It is when Ash is headless. And it's funny because it doesn't even involve the alien. But it's the most memorable scene to me from this movie. Because he's laying there with his android viscera all over the place, all of that white liquid all
milk
over
and
him,
you know.
and still talking to them. But it's just, I don't know why it hits me so hard. It's so ugly, visceral, scary, intimidating. Still, even in his, you know, head parted from his body, he's still scary and in control.
Yeah, I see what you mean by that. And I do like the decision to give him the more electronic sounding voice because he's damaged, which I think adds to the weird otherness of it and kind of gives it a bit more of a scare factor. I will say, I didn't realize this until, again, watching things that coming out now, you know, research for the podcast, that the latex mask that they made of Ian Holm apparently like shrank and really got messed up. So you can tell that there's a horrible jarring difference if you look between when it's the latex mask and then when it cuts to being Ian Holm under a table talking. Never have noticed it before, but now that's all I'm going to see. So I apologize if I've ruined that for you, but yeah, I can kind of
choose to forget it.
Anyway, yeah, just forget it. Anyway, what about you, GK? Favorite moment, scene?
I loved the whole self-destruct sequence where she's just trying to make it to the ship and she's running through the corridors, the lights are flashing and, you know, there's smoke and you don't know what's going to happen, where if it's going to come for her or anything like that. I think it's really well done, so I'm going to go for that. The tenseness of that situation is always gets to me, no matter how many times I've seen this.
Awesome. I have to say I'm surprised because I really thought that the chestburster scene would come out on top of this one, which I have to, it probably is my actual favourite scene, but I thought it was so obvious and everyone was going to see it. So I actually went with the shuttle fight at the end between Ripley and the alien. But I mean, if I'm honest with myself, it's the chestburster scene. It's just so iconic. So,
yeah. I had read that the first time they did that scene, they had trouble getting the puppet to break through. But yes, they left it in because it showed it more violence to the chestburster breaking out.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. Yeah, you can kind of see. Yeah, but they did make a track for it through. But yeah, it didn't break away as readily as it should have. So, what was your favorite line in the film, Sandy?
From that same scene, when they're got all the information that Ash is going to give them. And they're about to disable him for good. And Ash, as Ripley goes to disconnect him, he says, last word. And she says, what? And he says, I can't lie to you about your chances, but you have my sympathies. It's just so cold. And it's he's put them in this position. It's all his fault, knowingly.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. DK, over to you. Lying, please.
I can't lie to you about your chances, but you have my sympathies.
Same line?
2 for 2.
So cold.
Fair enough. Fair enough. My favourite line is a different one. It's from early in the film, and it is when they're examining the space jockey, and I think it's Dallas, says, alien life form, looks like it's been dead a long time, fossilised, looks like it's growing out of the chair, bones are bent outward like it exploded from inside. I love that line because it's all there. I mean, you talked about them not being stupid, but it's like you've literally seen the effect of what happens. You just don't remember that you've seen it, and it puts it, again, even if you don't register it on a conscious level, it puts in the audience's head, oh, something bursts out of chests.
Yeah.
So that when John Hurt starts doubling over, I think in your head, you're like, oh, shit. Yeah, that's the reason I kind of like that for the setup nature of it. Right, so... as I said, all that's left then is to give our conclusion and our score out of 5 stars. So, Sandy, you can go first because you're the guest.
I thought this movie was really well done. It achieved what it was trying to achieve, and that was to be scary and intense, especially the back half of the movie. It was a unique take on aliens in general, and I'm glad that it's been enshrined in film history as it has, because it really did, like you said, just so many movies have borrowed from this. It's just got so many iconic scenes. I give this film a 4 out of 5 stars.
Wow, okay. I expected higher for some reason, but okay. DK, over to you then.
No, I mean... none of you understand what you're dealing with, do you? It's the perfect organism. Its structural perfection is matched only by its hostility. But yeah, seriously. It's certainly head and shoulders in the franchise at this launch. And while I appreciate, I know what you're going to say, Mike, its success is equal to and above it in many respects. I just love this one. For its groundbreaking approach to sci-fi, it's tense, it's well-plotted, it has atmosphere in spades, it's well-directed, and I can't believe I'm saying that. To such a point, I can't reconcile that the director of this also directed Prometheus. So different are they. As I said earlier, each actor inhabits a role to an extent that for many of them, I'm always going to associate them with the characters. The production design is beautiful, and I'm not just saying that because we had Roger on the show. I love the retro look, especially for things like Mother. I like the model work. The special effects, to me, still hold up. And the recruitment of Giga to design the creature is inspired. The Jerry Goldsmith score is sublime. And to me, it's just one of the best horror movies ever. And it's a 5 from me.
Wow, okay. Cool. Well, there we go. I said about the film, and again, sorry, it's a bit long-winded. It's getting that way again. I said that it's probably redundant to say on a cinema classics podcast, but so much here is truly iconic and has gone down in cultural history. The creature designs, the alien life cycle, the commentary on humanity via artificial intelligence, which became a Ridley Scott staple. Whole scenes are works of art, examining the space jockey ship, the creature hiding in vents or shadows, and of course that infamous bit of chest bursting. That said, I really wish I loved and connected with this more. The pace at times feels sluggish, the lighting and cinematography frustrating and ugly, the story just a bit too simplistic. It's style over substance, but I do admire the heck out of the style. I just wish we could have seen a bit more in so many ways. Not to get too far into a different film, but I've made no secret of the fact that I think James Cameron's sequel to this is a masterpiece. That film just touches my heart and soul in a way that this one doesn't. and it's not for lack of trying on my part. But I also recognize that this film is vital to the sequel's existence, and so I have to give it points for establishing the elements, world, and the stakes. In the end, I recognize that this is a triumph of world building, production design, direction, and for the most part, writing. These elements are so good that it makes it all the more frustrating when I just want to connect more, to feel more engaged, see better lit scenes, see more of the creature doing the killing, and just clearer visuals, frankly. Still, the tension is palpable, and the film is a triumph of creating atmosphere. The acting also contributes to the realistic sci-fi world, a unique concept at the time. There's so much to acknowledge here, and I know that others love. I just wish I felt that extra bit of emotional connection, but I still have to give it a 4 out of 5, despite that seeming like I was being overcritical.
No, that's very much the kind of same vibe that I had with the Rocky Horror.
I did think that as I was thinking about it, and I was like, yeah, it's weird. It's one of those things. And it's weird because I adore the sequel, but anyway, go ahead.
I think that's why it was a 4 for me too, because it did just drag in the beginning, yeah. The front half.
I think we're used to a different pace nowadays in films generally, and certainly in alien films. I don't think if you made a film like this nowadays, it would fly. People would just be bored. But anyway.
It would be cancelled.
Yeah, we can't stop being woke anyway, but yeah. So yeah, what we always do.
It's got women and people of colour on the crew.
So the way we get our score, of course, is to add those three together and divide it by the number of us here, which is 3, which gives a final score for Alien on Cinema Classics of 4.3 out of 5, which is not too shabby at all. I think
no.
Despite the fact some of us were a little bit, you know, hot and cold on it, I think that's a very good score and shows the strength of the elements that, as I said, were stronger there. So, yeah. And that wraps up another trip down cinematic memory lane. Hopefully you're not too traumatized and you've all made it safely to your escape shuttles. Just remains for me to thank my intrepid crew here once again. So, Sandy, thank you again for coming on and guesting on the show.
Thank you. It was great to be here. And I just want to give a shout out to the aperture closures in the air vents. They didn't know what their job was, but they were doing them.
It's probably something phallic. What about you then, DK? Any last words on this? I know it's pointless asking where people can find you because it's the same places as always.
So. Sphincters. That's what they are. No, I can just be found here. Everything else, I'm absent without leave.
You can find me cradling a framed photo of James Cameron and watching episodes of Red Dwarf, or alternatively use the image that'll be up on screen on YouTube to track down all of our various social medias. Or if you're not watching on YouTube and don't have those visuals, use the link tree in the episode's description, and we're always willing to hear your thoughts on any of the films we review, anything else at all, any you know, anyone who wants to come on and be a guest, feel free to put your name forward, and let's get engaged, let's get talking, and you know, join us maybe on the Silver Screen movie Facebook group as well, where things are starting to get a bit more active. So yeah, hopefully we'll see you around the worldwide webs. And yeah, that's it for this episode of Cinema Classics. We'll be back next month. We're a monthly show, but in the meantime there is Silver Screen regular flavor and DK's cult classics. So yeah, do join us for all of that. Keep an eye out on all of our various socials and on YouTube to see what's coming. And yeah, hopefully we'll catch you all again here soon. In the meantime, this is Wilson, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off.
You've been listening to the Silver Screen Podcast, hosted by Michael Wilson and DK. Produced and edited by Mike Wilson. Additional material and behind-the-scenes sections by DK. Follow us on social media. Links to all of our social media pages can be found via the Linktree page listed in the episode's description. This podcast is part of the Mike's Podcast Network. You can listen to this and our sister podcasts on all good podcast providers by searching for Silver Screen Podcast or Mike's Podcasts. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share far and wide. Thank you for joining us. Come back next time for more movie magic, and hopefully this can be the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Cut!
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.